All right, this is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in history, and I'm here in the office of Stephen Norton, Professor Emeritus with the Climate Change Institute, and we're here to talk about his experiences with the Institute. Okay, so to start us off, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about how you got interested in the kinds of research you've done.
That's a very tortuous path. I became interested in geology, the broad topic of geology, when I was about 12 years old in the Boy Scouts. And I was climbing Mount Washington in New Hampshire and came across a rock, and it had an interesting mineral in it, and I didn't know what it was, and I asked my scoutmaster what it was, and he didn't know. And so, being compulsive, I set out to find out what it was, and since then I've sort of been interested in geology. And got my geology merit badge in Boy Scouts, and there were two levels of interest. One was, what is it, which is very descriptive, but the fun part is finding out why is it, or how did it come to be as it is. So all the way through high school, I was pretty darn sure I wanted to be a geologist, and I didn't really understand anything beyond that. I was interested in the Earth, and so I applied to undergraduate schools, and basically just after a good undergraduate education, and then I would go on to grad school in geology. And I had it all mapped out. I was going to go into industry and get some experience, and then go into academia, thinking that the experience in industry would be a good thing to do. And a funny set of circumstances occurred. I was a pretty good student in my undergraduate school, and I got a National Science Foundation fellowship for all 5 years at Harvard. Worth a lot. A nice thing to have had. But at the end of my first year, I had nearly flunked out of Harvard because of some social, emotional things that happened to me. And as a consequence, I lost my National Science Foundation fellowship for 5 years. So I had to fall back on, and I say that in quotes, the other opportunity which immediately came along, which was to be a teaching assistant in a beginning geology course at Harvard. And it's the equivalent of Geology 1 here, or Geology 1 anywhere. It was called Natural Sciences 10.
And this was when you were just an undergraduate?
I was first year graduate student, but okay. I flunked out of, not flunked, but did not do well enough to justify me being continued as a National Science Foundation fellow. And so I became a teaching assistant my second year in grad school, and I loved it, and I was reasonably successful at it, and I continued as a TA for 3 more years, and then when I got my PhD, I was put in charge of the course for a year, sort of a postdoctoral assignment where I just had to teach one course, and I got a full salary. It was a very nice situation. And then the chair of the Department of Geology here at the University of Maine was working in the Berkshires, Western Massachusetts, and I was assigned to him as a field assistant. And I still didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do in geology, and I was trained as what we call a bedrock geologist to understand the kinds of rocks that are part of the bedrock, not what's on top, the soil, but the bedrock and the history of it, how it came to be in the condition it's in, whether it's an igneous rock, metamorphic rock, sedimentary rock, whether it's been folded and faulted and metamorphosed and so on. And so I worked with Phil Osberg, who was the chair here at the time, from 1964 until 1968, which was the end of my postdoc year at Harvard. And back in the old days, chairs and departments could just reach out and say, we want Adam to be on our faculty. Nowadays, you wouldn't do that. You couldn't do that. Equal Opportunity would insist that you have a nationwide search or an international search, and that every type of person, every color person, every ethnic group is encouraged to apply. But at that time, they could reach out and say, Steve, we'd like you to come to Maine and teach structural geology. And that was one of the things that I'd worked in as a graduate student. And I came here in 1968 in the fall, and I was the sixth member of the department. There were five, and I'll come back to that in a bit, but I was the sixth member of the department, and now there are about 15 in earth sciences, plus some sort of joint appointments and adjuncts and so on. And I continued to do bedrock research in the Berkshires and then switched to doing bedrock work in Maine. And after perhaps 2 or 3 years, I said, I'm not having fun in my research. And I didn't get a PhD to not have fun. I mean, it was, what I was doing was no longer on a steep, steep learning curve, and it just didn't really excite me the way I hoped it would. What else can I do? And I just naturally gravitated into what I do now, which is what I describe as aquatic geochemistry. I worry about what determines what's in water and how water impacts soils and bedrock and how water behaves in lakes and streams and how water behaves when it interacts with humans. So it spans all the way from natural processes to pollution. And I had had a couple of really fine courses in graduate school that sort of got me started, and then the rest was just lots of reading and lots of doing and making mistakes and slowly but surely learning the trade and becoming better at it. And that's where my graduate teaching ended up too, is in the field of aquatic geochemistry, where I taught two graduate courses, and I taught one of them a year ago. But I continued to love to teach that beginning course, and I taught that until about 5 years, 6 years ago now. And I always loved it because I always felt that students, most students at the University of Maine or most universities are only going to take one course or two courses in science. And if they're lucky, it'll be a geology course. And if they're really lucky, that course will set them up to be better able to enjoy what they travel through and over and under, rather than not even seeing what's there and trying to figure out what's going on and being curious about it. That was my job, not to turn them into geologists, but to turn them into curious observers, and they could ask questions. So that's how I came to be where I am now. And except for two sabbatical years in Norway, the country, I've spent all my time here, and I've had a wonderful time, and wonderful students, and a wonderful place to work. And I never called it work. I always went to school every day. I always described it as, got to go to school today. That was kind of neat. And I got reasonably well paid for it, so that was kind of nice too. If I go back to the department was formed, split off from civil engineering back in the early 60s. And our first chair, this is a story about serendipity. Our first chair was Philip Osberg. He's the guy who hired me. So I owe him my whole career in some respects. It's just a fork in the road. He said, Steve, we want you to go down that fork. Come join us. And I did. At the time, in the early 60s, University of Maine was largely a teaching college. I wouldn't describe it as a university. To me, a university is a comprehensive establishment that has graduate programs and research, and it's very diverse. And there wasn't much of that going on. Most people just taught. And they had appointments that said you'll teach three courses in the fall and three courses in the spring, and you might do a little research on the side, but it was never part of your job description. Phil, bless his heart, went to the administration and said, I want to make a deal with you. I want my new faculty to be 50% teaching and 50% research. And they will do the following and be held accountable for it. If they don't do those things, then they're gone. And so when I came in, and everybody subsequent to me, and actually a few before me, it was with the understanding that you will teach a couple of undergraduate courses, and you will teach a couple of graduate courses, no more than three or four total, and then you're going to seek and be successful at getting outside resources to support graduate students like Adam. And that's the way you'd be judged. And, of course, produce the peer-reviewed publications.
Was there a set number of publications you needed?
No, that would be way too artificial, because a publication every other year in one journal is just as important as three publications in so-so journals every year. Mm-hmm. Case in point, I had a PhD advisor who perhaps had 20 publications in 35 or 40 years. But he was in the National Academy of Sciences by the time he was about 45, because the first 10 were so seminal to the discipline that he represented. I mean, they were earth-shaking articles. And much more important than just going out and describing the geology right here and publishing it. That's important, because that's the way bigger concepts evolve, is putting the pieces of the puzzle together. But if you just had a few pieces of the puzzle, and you only had one every 3 years, that's not going to do it. You either have to have a really big idea every 3 years or lots of little ideas.
And for the listeners, the National Academy of Sciences is what, the most prestigious scientific
It's the most prestigious organization in the United States. Every major developed country has one. It is more or less recognition of international status, international standing, and a long career of very high productivity.
About how many scientists are admitted to?
I would say less than a tenth of a percent. I only know of two in the state of Maine. Mm-hmm. And one is George Denton in our department. And I think he was the first person in the state of Maine to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences. And you are elected by your peers. There's probably a little bit of political aspect to it, but it's, I would say, probably 95%. Look at what this person has accomplished in terms of his or her contribution to their discipline. So Phil made this arrangement, and that's the set of conditions I came into the department with. I was the sixth member, and we had Phil Osberg and Harold Borns, whose name comes up again and again and again. He is the grandfather of the Climate Change Institute. Grandfather because the Climate Change Institute came from the Institute for Quaternary Studies, which Hal founded. But there's a serendipitous story there, too. Hal Borns was trained at Boston University as a PhD in bedrock geology. And that's not what he does for a living, either. So he's, in a sense, I'm parallel to Hal. He mapped geology in Maine and did it well. And I think he got to some point where he said, I'm not having fun. So he said, I want to go back and do a postdoc and get retooled as a quaternary geologist. And he did. And he went to Yale, I believe. And you can confirm that by checking on his CV, but I think that's correct. He studied with somebody named Richard Foster Flint, who was the premier glacial geologist in New England. Well, Richard Foster Flint was getting close to retirement. And when Hal came back here with this new training and thinking through new vision, new glasses, he said, we have an opportunity at the University of Maine to occupy a niche which in the very near future is going to be empty. Harvard had gotten rid of its quaternary geology. Yale was losing its quaternary geology. No other university or college in New England had more than one or two people teaching quaternary geology, either glacial geology or glaciology or anything close to it, or climate science, which has hardly been invented then. So he said, we have an opportunity to occupy a niche. The nearest competitor was Ohio State. So Hal said, let's go after that niche. That's a place we can compete. We can't compete with Harvard in petrology. We can't compete with Dartmouth in something else. We can't compete with Yale in something else. But here's a niche. And it was his vision and his persistence that enabled us to convince the administration that in the pattern that Phil Osberg had established, if you give us some resources, this is what we'll produce, and we'll be held accountable for it. So the next year, with this permission, we went out and got George Denton. He was the first hire. And he was a wonderful hire. He's been a fantastic teacher, fantastic scientist, and he's produced fantastic students, both undergraduate and graduate.
So you say we, so that implies that by that point you had already become involved in
the department made the decision. And
so pretty much by default all faculty in the Department of Geology became
No, this was going to be a separate institute, and the original member was Harold Borns, and then Denton, and then several other people were identified on campus. But more importantly, we said, if we fill out the disciplines appropriately, we're going to have to go after a paleoecologist, and that's George Jacobson. We're going to have to go over, get another aquatic paleoecologist. That's Ron Davis over in botany, which no longer exists. It's now part of biology, the School of Biology. And so on. So quaternary geology is not just geology. It's a multidisciplinary area. It came out of thought processes that occurred in geology. And the group of six of us who said this is the way to go, only one went into the Quaternary Institute right away, and that was Hal. I was doing the kind of research after about 3 years here that is totally consistent with the goals of the Climate Change Institute. See, to me, climate change is physical climate and chemical climate. And the chemical climate of Earth has changed over the short term and over the long term. And when watersheds are glaciated and then deglaciated, things happen over the next 5 to 10,000 years that are controlled by my kind of chemistry. And the lakes change in response, and the soils change in response. So the evolution of our ecosystems is something that I was working on, but it wasn't identified as being central to the original mission of the Quaternary Institute. So the Quaternary Institute grew, and it was highly successful because it was very selective in terms of getting very good people and holding them accountable. And a few people came and didn't fit. Either they weren't productive or they weren't part of a good working group, and they left, in most cases of their own free volition. In a few cases, they were told to leave. And those decisions are made by faculty and administrators. And it just grew and grew and grew. And I was working with people in the Institute all the time, but I never felt the need to be a member of it, because at the University of Maine we're small enough and friendly enough so that I can go downstairs and work with anybody, or I can go in the next building and work with anybody, or I can collaborate with somebody in civil engineering, which I do.
Were you involved in maybe some of the early brainstorming sessions, say with Hal, about forming the Institute itself?
Oh, yes, that was a collective effort of the entire Department of Geology. Oh,
okay.
Yes, but all agreed this is the niche we should occupy.
But some of whom, like you, knew those, you would not be in that, but you participated.
I never even thought about it as being important. I mean, I was a geologist. I was in the Department of Geology. I could do my thing. And if we could build this other program and it has more dimensions than just geology, that's fine. That's fine. I wasn't covetous of the resources, and I wasn't afraid for my own position. It just seemed like a good thing to do. And everybody agreed on that, and everybody got behind it 100%. And Hal just was, he was the quarterback, and he carried it and just did a magnificent job of figuring out how to organize it. And that's one of the strengths of the Climate Change Institute, is how it's organized. Every member of the Climate Change Institute has a mother department. They're either in geology and CCI, or they're in chemistry and CCI, or they're in biology and CCI. Everybody has a mother department. They're all joint appointments. Paul Majewski, the current director, is a member of geology. And when you get tenure, the CCI, Climate Change Institute, does not grant tenure. The mother department does. So people get tenure in a department. And that was a brilliant thing to do, because that keeps the departments engaged in the success of the Climate Change Institute. We want our people to succeed. And if they're in the CCI, that's great. And the CCI has people on what's called the peer committee, which help make the judgment that you, Adam, are judged worthy to continue or not. So both parties have a vested interest in the outcome of the success of you and me and all the other people in the Climate Change Institute. It was a brilliant move on Hal's part to design it that way. If you set up a separate Climate Change Institute and it has its own faculty lines, its own salaries, then it becomes a battle. We're not going to let you use our geologist over there. We want our geologist. But shared works. Shared works. And that was the genius of the organization, and it's worked very, very well indeed. And not all universities have figured that out. Anyway, moving forward in time, we went through several directors, and I say that in a positive way. George Jacobson was a director of the, I guess it was called the Institute for Quaternary Studies when he was there, yes. And George Denton served, Hal served, and I hope I'm not leaving out somebody outside geology, but it's traditionally been somebody in geology. And then, I don't remember when it was, we have always reached out to other universities, and Paul Majewski had been here as a postdoc working with George Denton. And Paul changed his career too. He was a glaciologist, I think, or a glacial geologist, one or the other, but not an ice core geochemist when he was here. But he went off and did some time at, I think, Ohio State, and then finally ended up at the University of New Hampshire. Built a very successful program, and they were emphasizing something there that we didn't do at all. They were emphasizing ice core chemistry from coring sites in the Antarctic and Greenland, and Paul had headed up some very important projects, international projects. So he had a dimension that he could add to the Climate Change Institute or its predecessor that we didn't have, and we had dimensions here that they didn't have at UNH. So let's get together and talk about exchange of faculty, exchange of students, and cooperating on research. So one serendipitous day, George Denton, have you met George yet?
No, but you
met George Jacobson.
Yes.
So those two Georges and I was chair of the department at the time, I think. We went down to UNH to spend a day with Paul Majewski and his group. And there were presentations about our program, their program. We got a tour of the very nice facilities down at UNH, and it was clear that they had some dimensions to them that we didn't have, and vice versa. And so we started talking about collaboration, and it was very positive. And that night we went out to dinner, and I'll shorten the story a little bit, but basically Paul said, there's only one place else that I would ever consider going from UNH, and he said, that's to Maine. I went and told the two Georges, and a year or so later, Paul was here. And again, it was because of a change in the attitude at the University of Maine that we can compete. We can't compete in all fields, but we have some resources, and in this case, we put the resources into bringing Paul here with several other scientists and making it comfortable for him to do the kind of science he wanted to do here. And the rest is just a very positive history. He's continued to build the diversity of the Climate Change Institute and strengthen it, and he keeps adding dimensions to it with concurrence from all the CCI people. Now I am a member of CCI, we have people from at least a dozen departments, two or three engineering departments, and science and biology and geology and on through the university. Yes, you can stop that if you want. Hi, how are you?
I just wanted to wave at you.
Are you flashing? So where were we? Oh, we're moving forward in time. So that about brings everything up to speed. And it was actually after Paul got here that Paul looked at me straight in the eyes and he said, "How come you're not a member of the Climate Change Institute?" And I said, "Well, I am in everything but name. I mean, I work with half a dozen people in the Institute." And he said, "The procedure is you have to submit your CV, your curriculum vitae, which says what you've done in your life, and then you give a public talk. And if you don't fumble that one too badly, then you are invited to be a member of the Climate Change Institute with all the rights and privileges there too. No money, no transaction, but it's good for me to have that affiliation. I can say I'm a member of the Climate Change Institute, and it's probably a little bit good for them to say that we have a geochemist on the in the staff who does the following kinds of things, and he's a productive guy, and so on. So it's a mutually beneficial thing, and a lot of people such as I have joined CCI simply because we do offer something to them, and so it's worked.
So I understand that the Quaternary Institute and now the Climate Change Institute, one of the ways it's changed since it first began is that it simply grew. There are many more members now. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the scope of inquiry has changed.
Well, the original scope, let's say from infancy, was glacial geology, which is the study of the formation of and distribution of landforms and materials related to ice. And then it expanded when we hired a glaciologist, which is a person who deals with the physics of ice and the movement of ice and ice's ability to move materials. And then we added computer modeling, because ice movement is not just ice flowing downhill. It's very intricate physics, almost down to the molecular level. And that lends itself to computer analysis, so that you can predict how glaciers are going to move and how fast and how to change their rate of movement and their rate of accumulation and so on. But we also didn't want to ignore the terrestrial part of it. Not everything is ice and snow. And so out in front of the glaciers, you have dynamic landscapes, and they have vegetation which is evolving. And so you add paleobotany, which is George Jacobson. You add aquatic paleoecology, which was Ron Davis and lake sediments. And then you add geochemistry, and I can look at chemical changes through time by looking at lake sediments. And then you add ice cores, which tell you about the atmospheric chemistry and the circulation of the atmosphere and the source of pollutants in the atmosphere. And pretty soon you need engineering expertise, and then people start saying, well, if the climate is changing, that means not only is the flora changing, the plants, but plants support the food chain, and so all the animals are changing. And so then you get into people who are worried about migration of organisms and birds and insects and disease vectors. For example, we have ticks that are now migrating up the interstate into Maine with their various diseases. And all of this is related to climate change. And so it's getting more and more holistic. Climate change is the biggest problem our species faces. And so understanding not just the fact that climate is changing, that's pretty easy to do. Just measure the temperature every year and take long-term averages, or look at the ice outs on lakes and see that ice is going out of the lakes earlier and earlier every year, or look at tree growth or migration of tree species. But we're right in the middle of all that. And so we're getting to the point where we are going to start dislocating where we grow food, where we have enough water, and so on. All the limiting resources for humans. And that means that we're getting economists involved, we're getting climate modelers involved, we're getting the social side of things involved. I mean, we know historically from anthropology and archaeology that humans have suffered as a consequence of climate change. That wasn't really well recognized several decades ago, but now it's pretty clear that humans through time have been subject to the vagaries of natural climate change. But now we're into something apparently that's very different and faster. And so the Climate Change Institute, I suspect, is going to continue to grow by adding selective people who are interested in the interaction of some aspect of human species and the natural world. And the only worry I have is that we get so big that we sort of start to feel amorphous. I mean, one could argue that most of the University of Maine could be reorganized around one fundamental problem, and that's climate change. I mean, it is such a big thing down the line that Columbia University, where she is studying now, Bess, who just walked in, organized their undergraduate curriculum around Earth. Not every course. I mean, music doesn't have to relate to Earth, but a lot of stuff can be related to Earth. Well, a lot of stuff is going to be related to climate change. Everything we say, everything we do, how we grow things, how we travel, it's all going to be linked closely or tentatively, but it'll be related.
Outside the scientific community, the human role in climate change seems to be very much still up for debate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you can comment on why that might be the case.
My answer for that question is the same as the answer for any situation where somebody has either beliefs based on history, their history, or an ulterior motive. And I think it's sad that there might be people whose ulterior motive is to be in denial about climate change because of economic arguments for them personally, or the company they work for, or the people who vote for them. But I believe that there are people like that. Don't ask me to identify them, but I believe that's true. But the other part is your own personal experience, your education, makes it hard for you to accept something that runs counter to your experience. And I go back to my undergraduate teaching when we would talk about evolution, for example. And there are people who don't believe in evolution. The fundamentalists do not believe in evolution. And yet, their position is not testable. But evolution is testable. You can ask questions of evolution. If evolution is true, then we should be able to make the following observations. The absence of being able to make that observation doesn't mean you're wrong. It means we can't make that observation yet. But we keep seeing more and more evidence that evolution has occurred by any criterion we want to come up with. And we can see evolution occurring in the laboratory. Antibiotics. The development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. These are things happening at a speed that is sufficient for us to observe them. So evolution is pretty darn clear, and there's no other explanation that comes across that works. So there are those two kinds of things that make people not be able to accept a new idea. I would teach about radioactivity to students because I thought it was important to them. It was a social problem. People are afraid of radioactivity. And by the end of a week, we had talked about periodic table and the fact that there are radioactive nuclides that occur naturally. You've got radioactive carbon in you. Carbon-14, you've probably heard of it. We use it to date, to age organic materials. You have radioactive potassium in you. You have radioactive, and there are about 20 things that occur naturally that are we've been living with forever. We evolved with them. And then we get radiation from space, ionizing radiation, which can cause problems. Anything with the word radioactive or radio in it sets off alarms in some people because they've been told about how terrible radioactivity is. Well, in the form of a bomb, it is, or in the form of accumulating a lot of unnatural radioactivity, it is. There have been thousands of people killed by radioactivity. Thousands. But there are 40,000 people a year who are killed by automobiles in the United States. But you don't see people particularly horrified of driving a car. And you can't always control the other guy. You might be a good driver yourself. So the only way to get people comfortable with climate change, if they're not scientists and they're in denial, is to present them with data that they can grasp, perhaps with your help, that undeniably leads to the conclusion that it's getting warmer. Ice outs, for example, or mean annual temperature over 40 or 50 or 60 years. From this year to last year, that's not climate change, that's weather. Climate change is long-term. And there's a lot of noise in the climate. There's normal variation. The last few days have been abnormally cold. If we had a whole summer like this, we'd say global warming is over. No, it isn't. That's just one summer. But if you had a 50-year average and the slope is positive, getting warmer and warmer on average, then one has to say, in general, the climate is warming with variation.
I think that a lot of people would say, well, sure, there is global warming, mm-hmm. but humans didn't cause it. It's just a natural, cyclical warming.
That's more rational than saying that there is no warming, and there are still people who say there is no warming, than assigning the proportion of blame to natural variation versus you and me. That is more problematic. And then you get a little less secure based on the ice core chemistry and what we see about rates of change of temperature. It's changing rather rapidly right now. It's warming rather rapidly. You know, the 10 hottest or the 5 hottest years in the last 100 years have been in the last 10 years, that sort of thing. It's getting warmer faster. But that's also happened naturally too. There's a period of time 11,000 years ago, between 12,600 and 11,600, called the Younger Dryas, when the climate just prior to that was not too dissimilar from what it is now. And in the space of maybe as short a period of time as 10 years, the climate went into full glacial climate. Full glacial. And when that happened, a lot of biological processes were incredibly shocked and shut down. Where you had forests, they would die back. On Mount Desert Island, which you've seen in your 4 years here, we went from a forest to tundra vegetation. And then back to forests 1,000 years later. And going into the cold and coming out were very fast. So fast change is not unprecedented. And so the argument that it's changing fast now doesn't quite enable us to say that humans are responsible for all of it. But then you can fall back on physics. Carbon dioxide, all the laws of physics that you can discover in the laboratory and read about and that every physicist would agree to, say that if you increase CO2 in the atmosphere, that increases the ability of the atmosphere to absorb infrared radiation. That's heat, sensible heat. That warms Earth. And if you increase it maybe 100 parts per million, it's gone up more than that since you were born, just about 100. Then if you could just hold it there, then the Earth would warm up to a certain level and then sort of stay there and oscillate. But CO2 is increasing constantly at about 0.5% per year. And the laws of physics say more infrared radiation must be absorbed. And that means Earth's atmosphere warms. That means the surface of Earth warms. That means that the surface of the oceans warms. That doesn't mean the climate's going to cool or warm everywhere, because heat is redistributed on the Earth's surface. And so a blanket statement that more CO2 is going to make everybody warmer isn't correct. But the Earth will warm. And some places might cool a little bit, but on average, Earth has to warm. The laws of physics dictate it. And if the Earth's atmosphere gets warmer, more water evaporates. If more water evaporates, it just can't accumulate in the atmosphere. It has to precipitate. So if there's more evaporation, then there must be more precipitation. And so we would expect the amount of precipitation will change on Earth. On average, it will increase. And the intensity may increase because when you evaporate water, it takes energy to do that. When you precipitate water from the atmosphere, condense it from gas to liquid or to snow, that releases heat. And so there's tremendous heat exchange going on, and that exchange of energy, heat, is accelerating because of the warming of the atmosphere. So there are certain laws of physics that are undeniable. Now, how much do they play a role? It's not just CO2, it's not just water, it's dust, it's contrails from planes, it's volcanism, it's changing the surface of the Earth's color. By taking off the forest, you change the color of Earth and you change its reflectivity. If we could make the whole Earth white, Earth would cool down. If we can get rid of all the ice on the poles, it will warm up. So there are lots of things playing into the temperature, and there are feedbacks, some of which enhance the effects, some of which diminish the effects. Now those arguments are a little harder for the average layperson to grasp, but all of those concepts can be taught in high school, and there are teachers out there now that are touching on all of these concepts. What happens when you do this, 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 and this individually, and then collectively, if you put it all together, what happens? Well, that becomes really difficult. On balance, if you've got six different things going on, what's the net effect? Then you get into modeling, and that gets a little squishy. So changing people's minds who are not scientifically comfortable with or don't want to believe in climate change is difficult, and it's a matter of time. How much proof are we going to need that it's warming? In your lifetime, and maybe still in mine, we're going to lose all the ice during the summer across the North Pole. And you turn a huge area of Earth. Get a globe here. Most of this area here is covered by ice during the winter. And in the summer, it shrinks. And the amount of shrinkage is last year was the greatest it's been since we started recording it. And it was thinnest. I mean, this is all floating ice up here. There's no land up here. The Arctic ice is nothing but floating sea ice, and it gets up to 2 or 3 or 4 meters thick, and then it shrinks down in the summer, and it shrinks in its aerial extent. When that disappears, that means a huge part of the globe goes from white to blue. Blue absorbs, the blue ocean absorbs more heat than ice. Ice reflects most of the incoming radiation. So that's an amazing experiment that's going on. Well, when that happens, my guess is the circulation of the polar area is going to change rather dramatically, and that's an area outside my expertise. But those are the catastrophic types of events that may ultimately force people to say, oh gosh, I guess the climate is warming, and it's too late then. It's too late. It may be too late now. I mean, most scientists would now say, climate change is here, and we're not going to convince everybody in the world to scale back their carbon emissions to the atmosphere by 50%, particularly India and China, both of which are developing very rapidly. So CO2 is going to continue to increase. Even if it didn't increase anymore, the emissions, CO2 in the atmosphere will still go up at 0.5% per year. Even if we froze emissions worldwide, I don't mean freeze them like in ice cubes, but don't increase them anymore, we still exacerbate the problem for the foreseeable future, for decades at least.
Before it would level off.
Before it would level off and get into a new equilibrium and a warmer one. Exactly. So, now everybody that I know of in the Climate Change Institute sort of understands this. They're concerned about it. And some of us are trying to document past climate. And in so doing, you are better able to predict future climate. It involves, as you've brought up, many, many, many disciplines. Any one discipline by itself is just going to sit there and discover more and more evidence of the same kind. But with people working in diverse fields, you can all of a sudden start to assemble the pieces of the puzzle.
I'm wondering if you can give me an example of some of the interdisciplinary work you've done.
Well, I'm still involved in one, and since that's right in the front of my brain, I'll tell you about it. I've been working on a lake called Sergeant Mountain Pond. It sits atop Sergeant Mountain in Acadia National Park on the coast of Maine at an elevation of about 1,100 feet. If you roll back the movie to about 25,000 years ago, all of Maine out to George's Bank in the Gulf of Maine was covered with ice. And on the coast, it was at least a mile thick. When the climate started to warm, for natural reasons, about 25 to 22,000 years ago, the ice margin started to move northward as ice calved into the Gulf of Maine and melted, and it melted from the surface, and the ice sheet margin moved northward and it thinned. So the pancake of ice over Maine thins and thins and thins. And on the coast, Cadillac Mountain and Sergeant Mountain Pond were the first to emerge through the ice. And Sergeant Mountain itself would have been what's called a nunatak, sticking up through the ice. And here's this little pond right on the top. So it's Maine's first lake. We took a core from that lake, 2007, in March, through the ice. And the core was 5.5 meters, it's about 17 or 18 feet, of mud, which you would call mud. But I call it a tape recorder, because each year, about 0.5 millimeter of sediment is deposited, layer after layer after layer. And in that 0.5 millimeter of sediment is recorded the climate. And the climate can be reconstructed by looking at the pollen in that little slice of sediment. And George Jacobson looked at that core with me, and he found that for about the first 3,500 years, from say 16,000 years ago, which was the bottom of the core, to about 12,500, it was tundra. That's colder than here now. That's like northern Canada. And then all of a sudden, the forests appeared. And about 12,500 years ago, the forest shut down because of this Younger Dryas event that I spoke of, the rapid climate change for 1,000 years. The temperature probably went down 5 to 8 degrees centigrade and stayed average temperature. Well, that's about, 5 is about 9 degrees Fahrenheit to, say, 14 degrees Fahrenheit. That's how much the average temperature went down. The average temperature in Maine right now is 6 degrees centigrade. So if it goes down 6 degrees, that means the average temperature in Maine is zero, freezing. Well, that's what happened. And we see that in the core. We see it in the vegetation as reflected by the pollen. But we also saw it in terms of chemical changes that occurred in the sediment that are related to the presence of the forests. So as the climate warms, the soils are changing, the vegetation is changing, and the chemical signals in the lake sediment are changing. And I can pick up the cold snap, the 1,000-year cold snap, and then back into the forests again, and all the processes that happened before the Younger Dryas now start to happen after the Younger Dryas. And we see the evolution of the chemistry of the watershed, how the soils are developing, how the trees are changing. So that's an example of the kind of interdisciplinary work that I've done. And another person involved in that is Jasmine Saras, who's a member of the Climate Change Institute. She studies algae in lakes. And she looked at the algae in that core. And at the beginning of the history, 16,000 years ago, when it became ice-free, the first diatoms that were there were growing in water that had a lot of phosphorus and a lot of high pH, which means not much acid, very alkaline. Within a few thousand years, the diatoms were diatoms that grew with less phosphorus in the water and also lower pH, more acidic. And all of that is reflected not only in the diatom record in the core, which she studied with us, but also in other chemical indicators in the sediments. And I've just completed a study now of the same core, looking at a suite of elements called the rare earth elements. And it turns out that there's one element that controls the abundance of about 17 other elements in the core, and it's aluminum. And aluminum is an element you're aware of. You've heard of aluminum ladders and aluminum screens. Well, it's the same kind of aluminum, except it's in rocks. And aluminum has the ability to control phosphorus and its abundance in water, and it controls this whole group of elements called rare earth elements. And we can study all of these things coming up this core, and they're all behaving together, and they're all driven by the presence and absence of trees. And the presence and absence of trees is controlled by climate. So it all fits together. It's an evolving ecosystem. And this happens all over the Northern Hemisphere, where we have had deglaciation starting 15 or 20,000 years ago, depending on where you are. And so all the ecosystems in Maine, everywhere north of where the glaciers got to, are evolving fairly rapidly. Not in your lifetime or my lifetime, but certainly in five lifetimes. We can see changes going on that are natural. But then superimposed on that, we can see anthropogenic-related changes, such as air pollution. And I can study all those in that same core. And if I could draw in sound a graph for your recorder, if you could visualize the amount of lead that is deposited in the lake sediment over the last 16,000 years, it's been fairly constant. And then all of a sudden, 100 years ago, the amount of lead that's being deposited in the sediment in that pond increased to 50 times what it was. 50 times. And that's because of tetraethyl lead in gasoline, which you're not familiar with. We use different additives now for gasoline so that your engine doesn't knock. And it's also due to the burning of coal and the smelting of lead ores for batteries. In 1970 to 1980, we took a series of cores, one of which came from Sargent Mountain Pond, and it showed this tremendous increase in lead. And that's when Senator George Mitchell from the state of Maine and actually Senator Muskie, passed the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And the result was the recognition that what we put up in the air comes down. And they said we must implement measures to reduce the amount of lead and other things that go into the atmosphere. We did, and now the most recent core that I spoke of that we took in 2007 shows lead rapidly declining in the lake sediment. So we can use lake sediments to document recent chemical changes in the atmosphere as well. And that's all from one lake.
Interesting. Well, that's actually all the questions I had, but before we conclude the interview, I'd like to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
From my perspective as a researcher, what we learn about the past enables us to do several things. One is identify when things are going wrong. And there are various biological and chemical indicators in sediments, my research area, that enable us to identify when things are going wrong. if you just take a photo of what's happening today, that's what's happening today. You don't know whether you're getting better or getting worse. But if you have this time perspective, then you can say things are getting better or things are getting worse. It also enables you to see processes that are linked, that inadvertent changes occur when you and I tinker with the atmosphere or with a landscape, and we can see those things too. We get a better feeling of how things are connected so that we can anticipate what's going to happen better. They may not have happened yet, but we get the linkages. If we get more precipitation, we haven't had that experiment yet in Maine, what's going to happen? Well, we can get some insights by either looking at one site and its variation and see what happens in the short term, and then predict what will happen in the long term if we have a persistent increase in precipitation or decrease. So it's a learning tool. It helps. It teaches us about remediation for climate change. On an even more personal basis, though, doing science is really fun. It is really fun. Some of my most exciting moments have happened in the last 10 years when, by virtue of making a lot of mistakes and having a lot of experience, all of a sudden pieces of the puzzle fall together and you think, that's the way nature works. And that's a publication, of course, but more importantly, it's so satisfying to figure out how the puzzle works. And sometimes nobody's going to use that right away. But sometimes it gets picked up right away and becomes a very useful tool. I mentioned aluminum. Aluminum in water controls phosphorus in water. And we discovered this about 10 years ago here. And it's now generally understood pretty much around the world. And it explains why some lakes have lots of algae and others don't. And you grope around for an answer, and all of a sudden a piece of the puzzle falls in place. And so you have a solution to at least explain it. Now you can use that information to maybe design remediation, which is done with aluminum. And we weren't the first ones to use aluminum for remediation. Engineers discovered that in sewage treatment plants. But nobody suspected that it was happening naturally. So those kinds of moments are just, they supercharge you. It's such fun to unravel something like that. Now I do it for nothing. It's fun.
You had mentioned before I started the recording that even though you're retired, you're obviously still an active researcher, and it was just last year that you taught a graduate seminar.
Yes. Well, a course, a formal course. Mm-hmm. Yes. And teaching is fun. It's exciting to see people pick up something and all of a sudden start using it in a constructive way. The young lady who just walked in, Bess Kaufman, recently got her PhD. She went through my geochemistry courses, and just to watch her all of a sudden start using the kind of thinking that you need to understand process is very exciting. It's very positive feedback for a teacher. I sometimes wonder how some teachers who teach the same thing over and over again can get a real thrill out of it. And then I realize, well, for them, maybe teaching French well is just as exciting, just as rewarding. It just so happens that I love geology and I love figuring out how nature works. And other people are into other kinds of creative activity, art, music, philosophy, English literature, whatever. Everybody has their little gig that they do, and I really feel very privileged to have spent my career here, getting paid for having fun. When you think about it, I mean, it's hard work. I mean, as a younger faculty member, I probably worked 60 hours a week, year after year after year, and now I work 20 hours a week. So maybe on average I work 40. So that's just about right, I guess. But really feel privileged to have done something all my life that has just plain been fun. Sometimes when you're on a few committees, it's not fun, but that goes with the territory. And seeing bright young PhD students like you who are involved.
Well, thank you. Okay, I think I'll go ahead and stop the recording now.